Hey everybody, welcome to Create Cast, the show about people who make good. I'm your host, Chase K. As always, we have a really incredible guest. Today we're talking with Lynn Rosetto Casper, the host of the Splendid Table podcast and radio program from American Public Media. She's also an award-winning cookbook author and just sort of a go-to source for any food knowledge. This is a really fun conversation. We talk about everything from her early days in New York City, teaching Chinese cooking, to her work in radio, and also what she's doing in her own kitchen. If you're a new listener, welcome. CreateCast is a show all about rad people and what they do. Chefs, actors, musicians, you name it. We've had a crazy variety of guests already, so go back and check out our previous episodes. Make sure to check us out at createcastpod.com to sign up for our email newsletter, find out more about us and our incredible guests. Also, this season's giveaway is still on, so make sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to us in the iTunes store. We're going to be selecting one random commenter and one random email newsletter subscriber to receive The War of Art, an incredible book on creativity by Stephen Pressfield, as well as a CreateCast sticker pack and some other goodies. Of course, you can double your chances by doing both, so make sure to get on it. As many of you know, we're going to be running Season 1 all the way through the summer, and we've already had one incredible food guest, Kate Crater, restaurant editor for Food & Wine. If you haven't checked out her interview, go back and listen. And we've also got some cool chefs coming up. In just a couple weeks, we're going to have Chef Ludo Lefebvre of ABC's program The Taste, as well as a new Food & Wine best chef, Carlos Salgado of Taco Maria in Newport Beach, California. To hear those interviews as well as the other incredible guests that we have, make sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to us in the iTunes store or on Stitcher Radio or just on our website, createcastpod.com. If you haven't seen, CreateCast was just featured on the front page of the iTunes New and Noteworthy section, so we're really humbled and, you know, just appreciative of all the support that everybody's been showing. This podcast is a labor of love, so if you like what you hear, make sure to share on Facebook, tell your friends, you know, send out a tweet. Let people know about these incredible guests and what they've got to say. So, without further ado, here's this week's interview with Lynn Rosetto Casper, host of The Splendid Table. All right, hey everybody, we're here with Lynn Rosetto Casper. She is an amazing cookbook author and also the award-winning host of The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Lynn, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now, let's just start at the beginning. So how did cooking, food, how did they find their way into your life?
Well, I sort of was born to it. Both sides of my family are Italian, and it's one of those things where you grow up eating and people talking about food all the time, especially at holidays. You'd talk about what you were eating, then you'd talk about what you ate last year or what you ate yesterday or what you made or what you discovered or, you know, did you know that cousin so-and-so has decided to leave this out of her ravioli? And that discussion would go on for at least a half hour. But it was this idea that food was really central. And the other piece for me was, my mother had been very ill when I was born. She had arthritis. And, in fact, she couldn't lift me for the first year of my life. And in desperation, after seeing doctors, etc., she went to someone who had specialized in diet. And I was raised where we had no white flour or white sugar. In those days, they thought, you know, brown sugar was healthier. My mother baked everything that we ate that had, you know, any flour in it. There was absolute, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables. And by tradition in our family, every night there were four or five fresh vegetables plus a salad, and then a piece of some kind of protein. So it was an interesting way to grow up, and fresh was sort of the way we always went. I longed for frozen chicken pot pie sometime, you know, in the 1950s or something. But the other thing is that art and theater were my great loves, and cooking was something I just kind of did. It wasn't something I thought much about. I was curious about it. I enjoyed it. But as far as making a living at any one of those three things, art, theater, or food, when I was heading off to college, that just was not going to be possible. In spite of that, I had a theater art major, as I remember, and an English philosophy minor. those four things were guaranteed in combination to not ever get you a decent job. But as I moved out of the house, I was born and raised just outside of New York City. Couldn't wait to move into the city. And I ended up essentially having a chance at one point in my late 20s to look at what I really wanted to be when I grew up. And I went back to the things that I loved when I was in my teens. And I started writing. I started doing more artwork. And I cooked. And the more I cooked, the more I learned. And it was at a time when things were exploding in New York. You know, you have to imagine, this is the late 60s and early 70s. This is when the so-called food revolution was beginning. And I fell in love with Chinese food, which, of course, every Italian-American kid from Paramus, New Jersey, would do as complete rebellion against her background. And that's the first thing I explored in depth. And I was lucky enough to have a phenomenal contact, a woman born and raised in Shanghai, who, when special guests came, she was the husband of the wife, rather, of the art collector I worked for. When their special friends came, who were the Onassises, usually, she cooked. And I was her kitchen slave.
Oh, wow.
And I was, I cannot tell you the privilege that was. And also, just around that time, you know, we had Chinatown, which was this exotic, fascinating place. But around that time, a collection of cookbooks came out, the Time Life Foods of the World book. And between working with her and really being a slave, but learning so much, she was an utter perfectionist. And that book on Chinese cooking, which went into tremendous detail, that was the beginning of my being hooked on Asian food. And I actually ended up, we would do monthly banquets, and I actually ended up with people saying, will you teach us how to do this? And I would say to people, you know, it's the book I read. You know, I mean, I'm not an expert at this. And evidently they felt I had read more books than they had. So that's sort of how teaching began. And at first I was a teacher, and then I became a writer. But I was in the middle of this environment where James Beard was king, Julia Child, you know, the show had been on for 5 or 6 years. The first kitchen she cooked in public was the kitchen that I ran at one point at a department store. And that was the most amazing thing to work with her. So I was in the middle of all of this, and I was surrounded by people who were generous and talented, and I would find anyone who could teach me something, the local butcher who still cut meat from a whole carcass, and that's where I learned to cut meat. And then the history started creeping in, and the reality that food comes out of a mentality, out of a place, out of a collection of experiences that add up to make a place in the world what it is and makes it different from the place over the mountains or 1,000 miles away.
Yeah.
And that aspect of food really took hold well.
That's incredible. You know, it's so funny. I think it's food is so, you know, central to a place and it can really sort of define it. But at the same time, it's also so universal. I mean, I love how you sort of connected with Chinese cooking, which, you know, is very different from Italian cooking, but at the same time, I mean, has similarities, you know, for example, just in noodle making, for example. And I think that's sort of a really interesting parallel that you connected with that.
Well, you know what was interesting about it was I've always been fascinated by how things work and the techniques that are used. First of all, Chinese food is perhaps, this is one of those dangerous sweeping statements, but you know, Chase, I think this may be the most complex, culturally, the most complex cuisine in the world. Mm. First of all, you know, you could eat three meals a day, three different meals a day for the rest of your life, and never repeat a dish out of that culture. Mm. But also, the food there is art, it is self, it is philosophy, it is an essence. It's not a matter of you're a gourmet, you know. It's not a matter that food is out there and it's superimposed on the culture, whatever. It is part and parcel of identity. And I don't know, there's a wonderful novel called The Last Chinese Chef that really borrows, it's by, as I think it's Monique Moness, and It's a fascinating book, and in it are quotations, essentially, or paraphrasings of a great Chinese philosopher whose name escapes me. But reading the book, which I read many years ago, back in the days when I was teaching Chinese cooking, was such an insight. So that profound quality of being and food as being, I think, was something that I was exposed to early on, and it was kind of the core of what I kept reaching for as I began exploring Western cuisines. And I don't know if I can make that very clear. Does that make sense?
No, I think it definitely does, you know, and it's also just trying to sort of translate that sort of feeling or that essence to other people and also across cultures is something, you know, that's difficult, but obviously is incredibly worthwhile. So you mentioned you were teaching and then you were moving into writing, and as you started to write, you know, cookbooks and maybe writing for someone who was not all that familiar in the kitchen, how do you approach, you know, recipe writing and cookbook writing? I think a lot of people sort of take for granted being able to open a book and look at a recipe, but obviously there are standards that we sort of accept now that didn't exist before, and also, I mean, it's really difficult to translate something just over text.
I think absolutely, and it was something teaching helps you a great deal. The first thing about, I think, a recipe is know who you're writing for. Decide who you're writing for. And I remember someone a long time ago, and I can't remember his name, wonderful writer, and of course his name goes out of my head. He was criticizing someone who was very well known at the time of saying that when he read this person's work, he felt as though this person was looking over their shoulder, looking at you, saying, I can translate what this is about for you, but you can't really partake of it. You need me to translate. And this person was writing a great deal about the food of other countries, which that's how I began writing. I started writing for magazines and newspapers, but my first book is about a single region in Italy. And the goal was to bring this place alive and bring people into the life. And when I read that, I've never forgotten it. It's the key to teaching. It's the key to communication. It's saying, it's the difference between saying, essentially, let me tell you what I'm realizing versus experience it with me. And it's the experience it with me. It's I'm at your shoulder, and I'm not even teaching you. Really what I'm doing is I'm saying, come on along on the romp. And by the way, I've learned a few things along the way that may save you, you know, a little grief, a little extra work, or I've just found work well. And there may be other things that work well that I haven't come across yet.
Can you remember go ahead.
Well, the first of all is body language. Think body language. First of all, you begin a sentence with the most important action that has to happen. So even though it may be clumsy, the first thing you want to know is what size pot and what kind of heat, if you're going to cook, right? So, and I'll give you an instance. 99% of my recipes begin this way, I think. That may be an exaggeration, but, you know, there's an operatic side to life that you have to enjoy. So, okay, take a 12-inch straight-sided sauté pan, and you've got to say that because a lot of people don't know what the heck you're talking about when you say a sauté pan, and a lot of people don't know why it should be 12 inches. Because you say large, and for some people that's 8, and for some people it's 10. But you want a certain evaporation level of moisture so that the browning or the sautéing or whatever the process is happens in the most optimum way. So that's why you try to be exacting. And so you take this, you know, film the bottom of a 12-inch single-sided straight-sided sauté pan with olive oil. Now, film is, you know, it's not, you're not going to pour in whatever. If you want a little bit, you say lightly film. You don't necessarily have to measure that. Set over medium-high heat. So right away, you know the equipment you need, you know the action you have to do, and you know the amount of heat you need at that moment. And so, and you don't say to somebody, add the onions, and oh, by the way, you want it to turn the heat down to medium. You tell people, when you add the onions, turn the heat down to medium.
Hmm.
I don't know if that communicates, but it's that idea of, I don't want you having to guess. I really want to hold your hand, and in trying with the tone of the language to also kind of let you know, it's okay, it's all going to be delicious.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. I think that makes so much sense, and, you know, it's always frustrating. You know, there's sort of so many recipes all over the internet, and it's difficult sometimes when there aren't these sort of standards in place, or there isn't maybe a specific voice of the author. And you can kind of tell when they're not sure in their kitchen, and it makes you as the cook not sure of what you're doing. So
yeah.
I think that's wonderful to have sort of a specific way of presenting that. Now, obviously, you've had sort of a multimedia career, you know, teaching and then writing, and then obviously hugely successful with the Splendid Table. But I was curious, obviously, with radio and being on the Splendid Table, it's an oral medium, and when food is so sensual, and you know, it just as far as, you know, the taste and the touch and the smell, what do you attribute your success to? I mean, it's obviously sort of difficult to translate that.
I love doing food porn. I mean, really, you can describe. I start thinking about how something tastes, and I think the language gets juicy without you realizing it. The sensuality of you know, biting into something like a tomato or a peach, and the way the liquid can just explode in your mouth, and you feel the levels of taste that keep changing as you either chew it or it just sits there in the warmth of your mouth, and it just starts to spread. And of course, what's happening is a lot of that's the aromas that are such a big part of taste. And, you know, I think it's getting into it. And when you get into it, people are with you. And one of the funny things, I joke about this, but in a way I sort of feel sorry for my colleagues who work in that other medium, you know, the visual one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it limits the imagination.
Hmm.
So your imagination can take my words anywhere. And yes, it's wonderful. I mean, television is a great medium. But there's two factors that, in a way, is kind of limiting. First of all, you can only show in any one moment one single image. Whereas the way our brains work, in a moment, you could have, you know, a movie racing across your mind because of the power of suggestion. And the other thing is money. We can take you anywhere, and we can do it without having to worry about having a huge budget. But visual is so literal, you have to get the film crew, you know, to Iran. And that limits in some cases.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at how Tony Bourdain works with his show. I think that's one of the most incredible, brilliantly done examples of what food can be on television. Mm. And there's other wonderful examples. But, you know, people, when I first started doing this, people kept saying to me, you're going to do what on the radio? Are you out of your mind? You know, it must have worked. We've been on the air for 20 years.
No, absolutely.
I think maybe we may be getting it right for a change.
No, I think that's totally true. So I'm curious, you know, you're mentioning all these, you know, exciting foods, and you have a wonderful sort of descriptive voice. I'm wondering, what are some ingredients that you're excited about right now? What is inspiring you in the kitchen right now?
Oh, God, that's so hard to say because I've just moved. We've moved from 6,000 square feet, you know, one of those big old barns of a Victorian house, into 1,800 square feet. So I've had to really evaluate the pantry.
Hmm.
And I guess, all right, what's fascinating me now? I'm back looking at Thai food, but doing it absolutely everything from scratch and no shortcuts. And I'm just fascinated. And I am starting to really focus on working with galangal. And galangal, or galenga, is a member of the ginger family, or ginger is a member of its family. It's a rhizome, and it is peppery, dryish sort of in taste, a bit like ginger, and it's fascinating to work with. And The other thing is, at this point, I'm also fooling around with how to begin a sauté. Because, you know, there's hot oil or hot something, a hot pan, and in goes the food, right, that you want to sauté. And then there's the other method where you start out with a cold pan, the fat or whatever it is, and the food at room temperature. And you start from there. And when you do that with an onion, for instance, the onion releases a lot more juice. And you have to cook it a little longer to get rid of it. But I think you get a deeper, sweeter, more, I can't explain it, mouth-filling kind of robust flavor. And that can be important when you're doing something really simple like, you know, sautéed onion and some garlic, and you throw in some green beans and you let them cook. And you just get a different shading. So it's that kind of thing I'm fooling with. But the other thing is, I mean, I am waiting with bated breath for the herbs to start to come in. Mm-hmm. We're going to probably see it in another month. And I want to work this year, I want to work with the lemon-flavored herbs, the lemongrass, the lemon balm, the lemon mint. I just think it would be great fun, and to play with those, with fresh lemon, with, you know, what do you call it, preserved lemon. And then the stone fruits. I mean, the stone fruits for me are a pure, unadulterated romp. Mm. And I'm always fooling around with new chilies, I find. I can't resist them. So that's just a few things, but the reality is she walks past it in a market, especially the more exotic and unknown the better, and she's got to try it.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I'm sort of spoiled. You know, in California, the markets are beautiful, but there's actually one ingredient. It's funny that you mentioned lemon things. There's one ingredient here in Utah that I actually can't seem to find in California, and it's this wonderful varietal of spinach, and it's called lemon spinach. So if you ever find it, it's this incredibly sort of tart lemon flavored green, and it's just magical.
Is it truly a spinach? That sounds incredible.
Yeah, I believe it is a spinach, and it just has this sort of intense lemon flavor that's unlike anything I've ever had. It's really special if you can find it. Sort of one little final question. Just I consider myself, you know, very lucky that I've had the opportunity to sort of grow up in the kitchen with my family, you know, cooking a lot, but what is something that you would suggest to maybe someone who hasn't grown up in the kitchen and someone who is maybe a little bit older but wants to sort of make that discovery for themselves?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to my mind is learn how to make a salad. And the second thing that comes to my mind is learn how to cook in a pan a piece of protein. So it could be chicken, it could be fish, or it could be, you know, some form of meat. But to make a salad, how to wash the greens, ideally not from a bag, wash them cold water, you know, give them, let them sit in that cold water for a short amount of time, strain that out. I use the salad spinner, and what I do is the main part of the salad spinner is where I wash the salad. I give it a couple of washes, and then I just pour it into that part of the spinner that's like a basket. You know, with open holes. And then you can spin it dry, get it really dry. And then trust your instincts. Put it in a bowl, add whatever vegetables, fruit, whatever else you want in there, because anything can go in that bowl. And then what you do is trust your palate and your instincts. Sprinkle it with a tablespoon or two of good-tasting oil. Of course, I like olive oil, but any good-tasting oil. Very little. And toss and toss and toss and toss. And then a very tiny amount of vinegar or lemon juice. And toss and toss. And then taste. And then add a little more of whatever you think it needs. Oh, and salt. After you've done the oil, sprinkle it with salt. And when you learn to do that on your own, you can add herbs. You can rub the bowl with garlic. You can put, you know, blue cheese with the oil and vinegar, whatever you want. But you can now make one of the healthiest things you'll get in your mouth. And especially, you know, when it's warm out, being able to make your own salad, thin slices of watermelon with a peppery green, and then just simply oil and vinegar, salt and pepper, absolutely fabulous. So that's where I'd begin.
That's incredible. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful piece of advice. All right, so finally, a trio of rapid-fire questions for you. All right, so three fun ones, so just choose one. All right, Ketchup or mustard?
Ketchup.
All right.
No, wait a minute. Take that back. No. Mustard. Much more versatility. The All grainy right. type that comes in the crock that you have to give up paying the mortgage to be able to afford. Okay.
Okay, number two, red or white wine?
White.
All right, and finally, the real doozy, butter or olive oil?
Oh, my God. They're trying to pick your favorite child. Chase, that's not fair. Okay, which one do you pick?
You know, for me, growing up with biscuits in the house, it's got to be butter.
I am torn. I'm sorry, Chase. I cannot make a choice.
Well, you know, I think we'll let you off the hook. This has been a really wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate your time. So once again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, please. It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Once again, a huge thanks to Lynn for coming on the show. I know that she has a really busy production schedule, so we really do appreciate her time. That giveaway is still on, so make sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to us in the iTunes store, as well as visit us at createcastpod.com to sign up for our email newsletter. One random commenter and one random email recipient will receive those awesome prizes. For those of you that are new to the show, thank you so much for listening. And remember that this is episode 6, so there are 5 episodes right now that you can check out for free on either iTunes or our website, createcastpod.com. All of the interviews have been an absolute blast, and this show has been a total joy to put together. So please make sure to subscribe and stay tuned for all of the stuff that we have coming up, and go back and check out our previous guests. Once again, this has been CreateCast, and I'm your host, Chase K. Remember, make good.